Hello and welcome to Aviation Careers Podcast. I'm your host, Carl Valeri. And you know, if you're somebody who's interested in a career as an aircraft mechanic, I have someone who's seen it all in the battlefield and also through training for mechanics, actually here in the civilian world under Part 147. And he's going to talk a little bit about that soon. His name is Brandon Sanders. And we're going to discuss all things aviation mechanics and looking forward to 2024 and beyond, what's happening in the industry. Before we get started, though, if you're somebody who's looking to become a mechanic, there is a way to do that and not have a huge cost to yourself, and that's through getting scholarships. And we have a sponsor that's actually giving away 100 scholarships, guys, and that's that guy with over $120 million in scholarships for mechanics, pilots, engineers, everything in law, business. And that's the law offices of Robert M. Strumer, LLC. You can find them at strumerlaw.com. And they're giving away those 100 scholarships, guys, by using the coupon code STRUMERLAW. Again, the law offices of Robert M. Strumer handles various aviation matters, including FAA safety investigations and pilot medical certification. You can find them on the web at www.strumerlaw.com. And like I said, if you're a mechanic, please look at that scholarships guide. We're updating it every month, and going back at least 12 years on this show, we've had a lot of mechanics that have been on, and I know we haven't been talking about it. You noticed lately in the past episodes, we're talking more and more because I think there's a lot of great opportunities out there, and someone who's going to help me kind of put a little more color to that is Brandon Sanders. Hey, welcome to the show, Brandon. It's great to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to talk to somebody that's aviation oriented. Most of my day, I talk to people that don't know anything about airplanes. I have to explain a lot. Now I can just be myself. So I'm super excited about that.
Absolutely cool. Hey, for those that are watching this on YouTube and those listening, by the way, you got to check this out. Where you're actually in Texarkana, Texas.
Yep.
And you're
Texarkana,
in Texas. So the background there is actually there. This is not a photo. This is actually not Photoshop. These are real. JT9s, is that what you have behind you?
That's correct. Yeah, two JT9s. The one to my left back here came off of a United 747, and the one to the right, I believe came from an Israeli Air one. And so we're just trying to track down the serial numbers, but those are real deal original JT9 engines.
Yeah, and for anybody's in aviation, those aviation geeks out there, JT9s were workhorses of the industry from the 747 on. And if you've ever flown to Europe, you probably used a JT9 in your past, been on an aircraft that had one. But Brandon, you know, before we get into the whole maintenance 147, that kind of stuff, I always like to find out more about how people got into aviation and how their passion actually was brought forth. So why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your background in aviation, how you got into turning wrenches and fixing engines?
Oh, yeah, it's kind of almost by accident. Whenever I was younger, I wanted to be a missionary, and I had an old guy that was like, hey, what kind of missionary do you want to do? Because there's all different types. And I was like, well, I don't know. And he was like, well, like, you know, you should explore that. And I remember I was sitting at home watching a National Geographic thing on Brazil. And so I was like, oh, yeah, let's go out to Brazil. It'd be a cool thing. And there was a Cessna 182 that landed in the middle. So like, imagine like an old West town where there's like a main drag, and there's all of these shops opened up, and there's this Toyota truck coming down the road, and this 182 just comes into the frame and almost lands on the truck. The truck like dives out of its way, and the 182 lands, and I was like, that's what I want to do. So I went to him, I talked to him, I was like, hey, is there any like way that you could use aviation to do mission work? He goes, oh yeah. He starts talking about like Missionary Aviation Fellowship and JARS and stuff, and so that's how I wanted to go. Well, all those organizations require you to be both a mechanic and a pilot. And so I was like, well, you know, I started like mowing grass to pay for flight lessons, and I started hanging out around the airport. And the best way to get for a young guy that doesn't have any money to get into aviation is just hang out, and some old guy will scoop you up and put you in an airplane. And that's what I was doing. And I remember the first time that I took the push rods off of an old Seneca, if I remember right, dude paid me like $10 an hour to basically clean engine parts while he was working, and that was kind of my foray into maintenance. And so, getting older, I was like, well, I'm gonna go to college, and college is very expensive, and I didn't have a whole lot of money, as previously indicated, and so I bumped into an Army recruiter, and he was like, well, I can make you a pilot, and of course, I bought that hook, line, and sinker, and next thing you know, I'm in Baghdad. turning wrenches, and I've never been able to quite land the pilot gig, but I keep falling into, even if I try to get out of aviation maintenance, I end right back up in it, just kind of fate, I suppose.
So therefore, you decided to have them pay for that, meaning the military pay for this.
Yeah. That was my original thought. I could either go to school and pay for someone to tell me how to do it, or I could just learn how to do it, by actually doing it and get paid to do it. Well, the thing I totally didn't think about, because I was so kind of career minded at the time, I was like, how do I check these blocks so I can get off and start doing mission work with it. That I totally focused on the maintenance side of it, and I never forgot that we were in the middle of two wars. So I got to basic training, and the drill sergeant goes, "I want y'all to know that y'all are heroes." And I was like, "Heroes?" I was like, "This is whatever." And he goes, "Y'all joined during a time of war." And it's like, "Time of war?" And it's not until I'm standing at Fort Jackson that I was like, "Oh yeah, that's still happening." next thing you know, I'm there. I go off to Iraq, our first go around.
Wow, and that's an amazing story. And that's something you have to kind of do your research about, especially if you go in the military. There's a possibility of you going somewhere that there's might be a war happening.
Yeah, right. It's kind of a career hazard, I suppose. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't have changed it for the world, because it was the best thing to make me a good maintainer. I really became an aircraft mechanic on the flight line of Baghdad International Airport, turning wrenches, because there's certain things that you just never see anywhere else in the world until you get into that super high op tempo environment where, I think the first 3 months there, I probably manufactured and replaced more braided lines and hoses and patched bullet holes and did every sort of progressive inspection, watched helicopters crash, scooped them back up, tried to put them back together. I mean, all you name it, inside of a 15-month tour, I went from having no experience to having more experience than probably a lot of the mechanics that I grew up around, just because it's such an intense environment for such a compressed period of time.
Literally a trial by fire, boy.
Yeah.
We appreciate your service, but going back to something you touched on in the beginning, I'd like to, you went to the airport and you said you hung around the airport and you found somebody. And like you said, some old guy's always willing to kind of talk to you and take you under your wing. I think that is incredibly great advice. I mean, that is something that I think a lot of us forget, is that there's people involved in aviation, aren't there?
Yeah, that's something that I've come to really, really appreciate, is that we get so focused on airplanes and engines and all this other good stuff that we forget that honestly, at the end of the day, they're just a tool, and it's really a people business. And so the way that you progress is by getting to know the people and refining yourself as a person. I mean, I just finished recording our human factors class, and there was just so much, as I'm thinking through the Dirty Dozen stuff, I was like, oh yeah, I can remember this story, that story, this time, that time. And that class turned out to be longer than I expected, just because it's so riddled with actual real life examples of this is what, this is how you can do better by monitoring this in yourself, or helping out your buddy, by watching out for him here, there, wherever. So
interesting. So let's go back to going into the military. We, that was kind of very quick. You got in and then you actually got the ability to actually do some maintaining. Now, to understand, when you go in the military, they pay you from day one. Right.
Oh yeah.
See, that's something that's different than the civilian world, if you're going for your ratings. And that's something I think is really important. So with that said, the experience you got, and also the fact that you got paid to do that, would you still recommend people going into the military to become a maintainer?
Yeah, especially if you can get into a high operational tempo environment where it really becomes a pressure cooker, you can learn a lot. I mean, you look at it in 6 years, I went from I had no experience to I had all the time required. I just need to go take my test for my AMP. I got a bachelor's degree out of the deal, because they will pay now. You you're post 9/11, you can go on to school afterwards. But especially during that time, they paid for school, so I did school while in that 6 year period. I remember I graduated with my business economics degree in May, and then got my end of term of service in July, and managed to do all that. So it was really a way to get ahead. Coming from somebody who, I grew up in a single wide trailer in South Arkansas, I had no money whatsoever, and I was just how can I fix this problem and try to get caught back up? And the Army was probably the best choice that I could have made at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds like a great opportunity even today. And I think a lot of people pass it up thinking, oh, they'll just stay here in the States and go to a local school. I mean, there's advantages to both. But I think the fact that, you know, the advantages obviously of staying home is terrific because some people just can't join. And there's lots of opportunities there. We're going to talk about that here shortly. But I think we sometimes don't think about the military. I think it's a wonderful path for people to actually get their ratings. Now, you said that while you were in there, you learned all this. Now, how is it that you were able to come out and then get your civilian certificates?
Yeah, so that's kind of like the roughest part of my life is coming out of the Army because you get to so used to this running and gunning and like super high op tempo, and then you kind of come out and next thing you know, like you're out on your own and it's a lot slower, and the culture shock was pretty significant. But once I had come over that, it was I went back to the airport and started asking around. I was like, hey, like how do I go about actually? I know I can get, I have the experience. And like, you know, the internet had matured to the point where I could kind of Google up some answers. But like, you know, you're trying to read FARs, and whenever you're not used to reading them and stuff, it seems kind of opaque. And so I was just like, has anybody actually done this? Can somebody kind of like point me in the right direction? And there was a crop duster guy that I ran into, and he was like, hey, you should talk to my mechanic. That's what he did. And so I go out and like I traded a day's labor of like, you know, turning wrenches with this old guy. So he could kind of give me like kind of a skills assessment. And he wrote a letter and basically says like, yeah, like this guy's legit. You should like, you know, let him go take his test. So I go to the FISDO and he had also told me that, hey, look, go to, you know, part 147, I think it's appendix D, and lay out all the experience requirements that you need. And it's like things like, you know, have you ever changed a tire? Have you ever manufactured a start, you know, whatever the thing is. And I took all that out and I put it into Excel, and I put a one beside the ones that I had done and a zero beside the ones that I didn't, and averaged it out. And that you had to have 70% in every, you know, on these three, you know, general airframe power plant, you know, categories. And I think I had like 90% in airframe and power or airframe in general. And then there was like some power plant stuff that I hadn't done. So I was like, you know, in the 75% range. And so I take that dude's letter and then my little analysis and all the training records, every stitch of information I had, I go to the FISDO and I sit down with its inspector, and I'm like, behold all of my work. And like, and he stopped to look at it for a second, and on my Army, aviation maintainer certificate, there was an old Mohawk. Now the Army doesn't have them anymore, but it was like a fixed wing airplane that they use for forward observing, for like, you know, observing artillery fire and stuff. And he looked at it and he goes, oh, I used to work on that. And then just BS with me for like 10 or 15 minutes and then gave me my 8610s, which was just like the form saying that, hey, the FAA says that you can go take your test. And so I had like overcooked that. I was like super like worried about it. I really could have gone in with that and just like handed it to him, and he'd been like fine, you know. And so I wasted like 3 months of my life like trying to like prep for that test, or for that interview. But then I just went to Baker School of Aeronautics up in, I believe they're in Smyrna or Murfreesboro, like Middle Tennessee. Sat down and like, you know, they kind of put you through like a pressure cooker, like this is how you pass the written, this is how you pass the oral and practical. And I did that over the course of 2 weeks. I lived it out of the back of my truck. I bought like an old camper shell for my little Ford Ranger and just slept in it and just went kind of, you know, once a soldier, always a soldier kind of thing. It was like, I'm used to like, you know, eating noodles and like sleeping in terrible places. And so that's what I did. I just like, you know, like lived in their parking lot for about 2 weeks and went to class and went and took my oral and practical, aced the oral, just no problem. But then he gave me a project to you know, buck a bunch of rivets, and I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible sheet metal mechanic. That's not the thing that I'm actually good at. And so I completely messed that up. I remember he looked at it and he goes, if you were me, would you pass you on that? I was like, absolutely not. he was like, well, like you have to retest, and there's a process. And so I came back, I think a day or two later, and then redid it. I went back to Baker's, and Baker's really good about like saying like, okay, this is what you failed at, let's just try to work with you on it. And so I just, for 2 days straight, I just bucked rivets, bucked rivets, bucked rivets, and I went back to him and I you know, had to retest that portion of the test and passed it. And I'll tell you, it was a going from probably 14 knowing that I need to get my airframe and power plant to 20 whatever I was at the time was that was a huge milestone in my life. To like, I have the A&P, like I was like, it was like I had found El Dorado or something, you know. Super excited.
Well, the hat's off to you for just keep trying. You know, if at first you don't succeed, try again, as you did. And that's the process that you took through from the military. You know, a lot of folks, they may not want to go that route, and they want to go the civilian route. So let's talk a little bit about that. But first of all, As far as the mechanics license, quote unquote, the certificate, what different types of licenses are there in the civilian world that we need to look at?
Yeah, so let's say, like, to start off, like, basic aircraft maintenance, you have to have your airframe and power plant. So the airframe power plant, basically, you have to take a general test so that way you can sit for airframe. Now, you can get just one. You can do just airframe and never touch power plant stuff. But the industry standard is to have both because the aircraft are so integrated that, like, it's almost impossible for you to work on one without ever having touched the other, unless you're in some very, very niche place, like do an engine rebuild or something like that. And so, like, you get that. Once you've had it for, I believe it's 30 months, then you can get your inspection authorization. And that allows you to sign off on annuals. So, like, as an AMP, you can sign off 100 hours, and you can do a lot of other types of inspections, but there's certain inspections you can't do, and, like, the annual being the primary one. Addition to the FAA certifications, you have, like, you know, like, kind of niche things like the NCAT AET, which is an avionics specific thing. It's not, you know, widely recognized, but it is another type of certification you can get. I'm not aware of anything on the composites or structures side, and I'm sure there's probably something for power plant out there somewhere. but I'm an avionics guy, so, like, that's kind of what I pay attention to. So
if somebody's looking at this from, before we get into how to become one specifically, mm-hmm. there's a lot of, we have a big shortage in maintainers, period.
Yes, yeah, huge.
Through all parts of the industry. But you can also make a great living, and I'll just read off from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is 2022 numbers, by the way. The median pay for all aircraft and avionics technicians is $70,000. That's the median pay. It's about $34 per hour. There's many different levels in there. They do break it down, like, by avionics technicians being about $75, and aircraft mechanics and service technicians around $70, and installation and maintenance about $50. And remember, all occupations is $46. So you're above all occupations. By me telling you those numbers, is that what would you tell someone to expect, both when they come out first working as a maintainer and then possibly 3 to 5 years down the road?
Yeah, so I would say, like, those, a lot of those numbers, especially when you're pulling from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are skewed low. That actually the industry is actually paying a lot more. But there's nuances to it, right? So if you want to get into general aviation and just work on, like, Cessna 172s, you can expect a lot slower pace, but also a lot lower pay. But if you want to make a lot of money, you get into the airlines and you really start hustling. Like, you know, I think United just updated their entry, like, step one, 0 year of experience is like $36.90. So it's like the lowest paid guy making almost $37 an hour, and then, like, whenever they topped out, they're in, like, the upper 70s. And so, like, whenever you look at, like, if you're topped out and you're, like, on you know overtime, what does that money actually look like? And it's just, like, it's silly. And I'll tell you, like, I'm constantly doing market analysis because, like, I'm trying to hire instructors, and so, like, I'm having to compete against these guys to try to pull these old guys away to come in, which is, it's difficult for us. And, you know, we're just outside of the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, and so, like, we're still kind of subject to that market. And so you've got, like, people like JSX that are offering, like, $20,000 sign-on bonuses. That was never a thing. Whenever I came out of the Army in 2011, $20,000, like, I would have been like, sign me up. Be like, I can turn a wrench better than most of them. So, you know, that wasn't a thing, but now it is. It's to the point where even I was just looking at a job in Mount Pleasant, which is only about 45 minutes up the road from us. It's a 20-minute flight. A lot of guys fly out of here and go get gas in Mount Pleasant, and they're kind of like medevac helicopter guys. They're offering a $15,000 sign-on bonus in Mount Pleasant, Texas. Like, it's just like, wow. It's crazy. People playing relocation now, and on top of, like, these super high wages. And you know that since there's not enough like maintainers out there, like, overtime is basically a guarantee. Like, you're going to be working, you know, just like crazy. And so there's just no I mean, like, the sky's the limit how much money you want to make, you know.
With that said, you know, so I don't like to oversell anything as far as salaries are concerned, but would you agree that if you went to, especially with an airline, you could, without much extra work, make six figures?
Oh yeah, no problem. Like, that's like you can sleep to $100,000 these days. So
with that said, you know, for what you said about people staying home, how about opportunities for those that want to stay in a local area, just like in shops? How about there as far as making extra money?
I would say that like that is the perfect entrepreneurial environment because like I'll say like Texarkana, we have three maintainers. Well, there's four in the area. One travels to LAX and works 20 days out of the month. So he's not even really kind of a player in our market. Another one works for our Medevac guys. He's making like $150. Like he's making good money and like he's enjoying working on helicopters. The other one has a trailer and he pulls behind and works on like all the GA aircraft out there. And he's constantly just covered up with work. And I don't know what he actually pulls in from the maintenance side of his business, but I'm sure it's pretty decent because he's the only one that's out here. And because the only other one is me, and I'm teaching school. So
I tell you, they're worth their weight in gold for someone who's owned a small airplane. The guy in the truck that comes by and fixes it, I'm not only do we pay them extra because for them to come and fix it for us. You know, somebody wants to get into this, going back to being a civilian. There's certain types of schools that are out there. So you are you went from doing this in the military, came out, then you wound up here in the job as director at Aviation at Texarkana College. So you know something about the civilian world and how to get your ratings. What makes your program different? And can you speak towards that, especially when we talk about 147?
Yeah, so our program is going to be a lot different, and it's largely a function of timing. So this is going to get a bit of a story, but like the facility that we're in right now used to belong to a Southern Arkansas University's technical college. Well, they during COVID they decided to like close up shop and move everything to their home campus in Camden, and that left this facility totally open. Well, the local community college always wanted to play a part in at the airport, and so they started looking at like, okay, well, like maybe we can stand up our own 147. So that's going on. Then simultaneously, a new airport director came in, and he's like, hey, look, let's redo the terminal so that way we can put because back in the like not too long ago, like all we could park was like little Embraers, like regional jets, and there's not even like a jet bridge to get on and off. You're like literally walking on and off the plane, and so we have a new terminal that will open up in June that can take two 37s. And so he's like, let's see if we can overlay the runway to handle some like, twin aisle aircraft. So he starts to work on that and starts selling the airport as like, hey, look, this is a perfect place. If you're an MRO, if you want to leave your expensive market and come to a cheap market, hey, come on, because we don't really need a lot of like takeoffs and landings and fuel flowage to win. We just need jobs is really what we need. And so he starts kind of selling that. So you have the airport dynamic that's happening. Then at the same time, House Bill 8 in the Texas education board passes, and they completely redo the way that community colleges get funding. So now all of a sudden the money for the school is there. And then the big thing that really makes a big difference is that the FAA redid the Part 147 standards. So for 50 years, the A&P program was the exact same. So like whenever I got my A&P, I had to make sure I knew how to like put like dope on like wood aircraft and you check for rot and things like that. Things that you just like I've still to this day have never actually seen as an actual A&P. But like they got rid of that and they started to tailor the A&P program to be more heavy commercial maintenance. And they completely redid the standards that you have to test by. And so like we found ourselves in this very lucky spot. And one of the reasons why I agreed to come on to this job, because you take a pay cut and it's a lot different working with a school as working with an airline. There's not a lot of like get after it in academics like there is in the all the hustle and bustle and drama of real aviation. But the reason why I did it is because like you have all of these perfect, I mean, it's like one in a million type of alignment of all these different regulatory environments and business environments to where all of a sudden it's like if you wanted to redesign and reimagine what like Part 140 training could actually look like, this was it. And so I wrote a big letter. I was like, hey, look, if I'm going to get hired on to do this, this is what the program's going to look like. It's going to be like, hybrid in nature. So like, you're going to be like, if you're familiar with the Khan Academy, we're kind of following that to where you like watch a video, then you go and actually do stuff. And so our students will watch videos. Like right before I got on with you, I was filming videos on precision measurement. So like they're going to watch how to do that and then take like a little test, and they'll take another test the next morning when they come in. Then for 4 hours, we're just going to precision measure everything. So that way they learn by doing. it's also condensed down because whenever they did the 147 rule change, they got rid of the seat hour requirement. And so when you start calling around and like trying to do your research on like, what is a 147 done properly? What does it look like? And they're all like, look, you know, like you end up, you have to meet the seat hour requirements. And like, you know, it's 100 hours worth of actual like instruction and 300 hours of just trying to fill the seat hour time. So now that went away. So all of a sudden we don't have to take two and a half years to get an A&P. You can scrunch it down and say like, okay, like if we did this like every single day for 4 hours a day, we could probably do it inside of a year. And like, you know, talk to people like, yeah, you know, if you design the coursework that way, you could probably get it done inside of a year. And so like it'll be fundamentally different than any other 147 program that's out there. And it's kind of a big experiment. Like this is like, none of this has ever been done before because the regulatory environment had never allowed for it. Now it does. And so we're going to say like, well, let's try it.
So that actually is something that you're doing and makes it a lot quicker. Therefore, you can get out there and start actually earning a salary faster. By the way, 147, that defines the schools that are certified as for aviation maintenance technician schools.
Right.
And that final rule came out just, I think it was just a couple of years ago. I can't remember, but
yeah.
In the 147, it is a terrific thing because it's not just based on time. It's based mm-hmm. on actual the school and what you're doing. And I think that's great. I think that's terrific.
Yeah.
What now? You said something about MROs, and that's maintenance, repair, and overhaul. A lot of folks, I think, forget about that. They think about the airlines, et cetera. And me, someone that flies, you know, bigger airliners into those MRO facilities, these places are in the middle of nowhere. You can make really good money. Not all of them, but many of them are. You can make really good money, and where you are stationed, you can live like a king, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that I never knew anything about. So we ended up relocating to Washington. I started working in general aviation and had kind of like a boondoggle in that. And then ended up like walking on to an MRO. And I remember walking in my first day and I was passing by like up next to the hangar where all the executives park. There's like Ferraris, Lotuses. And I was just like, man, like, who in the world has all this money and stuff? And I get in there and I realize that like there's a lot of money flowing through this place. And we were like turning Southwest jets, Virgin, like you name it, like A320s, 321s. My first job was working on 777-300s for American Airlines, and I was just doing all kinds of stuff. And there are some of these guys that are like professional contractors that are just going from MRO to MRO and just making stupid money, bucking rivets and doing all kinds of fun stuff. So
and this is something I want to point out because there's a lot of feedback that I get from people as far as the maintenance mm-hmm. is concerned is why become an aircraft mechanic when you can go out and find other maintaining jobs that pay a lot better and also a better quality of life. But there are good quality of life maintenance jobs out there. You just have to understand where they are. So I'd like to hear your view on that. That's my words.
I would agree with that. Like, if you're going to get like be an AMPIA and all you're ever going to do is just like stay in like Malvern, Arkansas and work on, you know, Cessna 172s, well then, you know, that's just not where the money's at. But if you want to go and like, you know, relocate to either place like Bozeman, Montana has an MRO, you know, you can make really good money and live in a cheap environment that actually, you know, is going to make a big difference. Or if you want to go into say like Dallas and you don't mind, you know, kind of hustling and like working some overtime, you can make really good money there as well. So it's not just like I have the ticket, I get the paycheck. It's like there's other factors that you have to consider as well. Like you can be an underpaid anything. You can be an underpaid doctor if you're at the wrong market.
Absolutely. So. I'm glad you said that because it really is where you work and what you want to do. And there is a value, not just your pay, involved. And that value might be being home every night. And that's something to really consider in any job that you look at. So you got me convinced, and I've always felt it's a great job. Tell us a little bit about Texarkana College and where you are and what you do at the program there, and what are the opportunities for someone looking at this?
Yeah, so Texarkana College has been around for a long, long time. Texarkana had for a long time a partnership with Texas A&M, and they were co-located with Texarkana College. So you came to the junior college, and you literally just walked across the hall, and you were in A&M. Then A&M made its own campus, and that relationship started to part. And so there was a kind of like an identity crisis of like, okay, well, who are we now? If we're not just prepping people to go to university, what are we? And we started to focus more and more on like what they call workforce programs. It's like technical colleges. So like HVAC, industrial maintenance, and aviation maintenance was always something they wanted to do, but they didn't know how to go about doing it until they contacted me. And so Texarkana itself is about 75,000-ish people. It's very, very small, and it's very close-knit, so everybody knows everybody. It's really funny to get involved in one group, and the next thing you know, it's the same people in another group. It goes around, which is has its advantages and disadvantages. I mean, like we lived out of Seattle Tacoma area for a while, and like we didn't know anybody there, never saw anybody. And it can be, even though ironically that there's so many people there, it can be fantastically lonely and difficult because you don't have like somebody you can call to like help you like move the dirt in your yard or whatever the thing. And then at the same time, you have like small town antics, which can be like very Parks and Rec too. So there's a trade-off to everything, I suppose.
So and speaking of Texas A&M, by the way, I will say one thing. Texarkana is a great place. I think it's kind of cool. It's got that small town feel because it is small. You do get to know people. But I do know, having full disclosure, I lived in College Station for many years and a big Texas A&M fan. They did recently sign an agreement, so there is some type of pathway, I know. And you probably could speak towards that.
No, yeah, and that's something that's in its infant stages. So both the Texas A&M Texarkana just got a new president, and he's very focused on trying to grow the programs that are out there. And so, like part of that agreement is to create a A&P program that can translate into like a business management or aviation maintenance management program at A&M, and as well as like airport operations professional. Pilot, all these other programs that are in the making, but we're probably year 0.5 into like a 3-year process cultivating that. But it's good actually for our graduates, because by the time that we actually have graduates that are rolling out, they'll be able to just go right across the street and take our 2-year degree and turn it into a 4-year degree, which for a maintainer starting off isn't necessarily that important to have that degree. But whenever you start looking at trying to get into management and kind of promote up and accelerate your career, that college education really becomes the differentiator between like who becomes the manager and who doesn't. So
if you're interested in this program, by the way, texarkanacollege.edu, we'll have some links down in the show notes and obviously links to Brandon and the work that he's doing there. But take us through the scenario of starting to finish, how much time and how much does it cost?
Yeah, so starting off, like if you don't have to have any experience, you don't have any kind of particular background, just to be able to be admitted into the college. Once you get in, you'll show up, and we'll start you on general. We'll slowly progress you for about a semester until you're ready to transition to airframe. Airframe, we're going to focus a lot on like advanced avionics and composites. I just came back from, if you're familiar with Dark Arrow, just finished their composites class, and we're going to be integrating a lot of that into our coursework. You'll learn that once you do spend like the spring semester. Say if you started in the fall, and then you'll go into summer into power plant, and you'll be doing engine swaps on our Learjet and working on the JT9s behind me, doing fan blade inspections and that sort of thing. And so inside of a year or so, you'll have all the tools you need to be super super dangerous. And then we're gonna send you off to an airline or an MRO and let them take that raw material and craft it into something super professional.
Well, Brandon, anything else you want to mention as far as the program or anything else as somebody who's looking into this for the first time?
No, I'd say there is no better time than right now to be an aviation maintainer. The pay is there, the opportunities are there. Like Boeing is projecting like a worldwide shortfall of aviation A&P mechanics by 649,000 by 2042. 149,000 of those to be located inside the U.S. alone. So it's 149,000 jobs that like currently there's no machine to actually fill. So they're just going to go vacant. And so like you'll have the kind of pick of where you want to work, how much you want to make, what kind of life you want to live. And to get an A&P, especially through Texarkana College, is extremely cheap. I mean, like our course fees, I just finished them up the other day, and it was like going to be $2,800 for the whole thing. You have to you have small, you know, like the tuition cost that goes along with the college, but it's not very much. And if you're a Texas resident and you're like kind of economically disadvantaged, it could very well just be free. And so like you could go from this situation where you have no experience to next thing you're making six figures at Dallas turning, you know, 737s for American Airlines or something like that. And that really changed not just your life, but your family's life as well. And doing something that's a lot of fun.
So. A lot of fun, pays well, great opportunities out there. Just a great thing to get into. You know, Brandon, I'm gonna ask you a favor. I know there's those large engines behind you, and it kind of does look like a picture. A lot of people don't realize that those are freewheeling fan blades, and there's nothing directly connected. For maybe if you want to try it, go ahead and try spin one of these. And while he's doing that, remember it's texarkanacollege.edu. Check that out. I mean, for those that are, you can hear that. I mean, for those that are actually. Yeah. Listening right now, that's those big fan blades that are moving, almost bigger than you, and yes. They are absolutely incredible. And just think about that large motor just turning like that and freewheeling, and you'll learn how to actually maintain that and understand how to measure those fan blades. Well, thanks so much, Brandon, for doing that and coming here to talk to us about the Part 147, those schools, the opportunities, and it's so happy to talk to somebody who really loves what they're doing, Brandon. So thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. It's been great to share the story with you.
Well, if you have questions for Brandon or for myself, feedback@aviationcareerspodcast.com. We'll send them over to Brandon. If you want to get more information, texarkanacollege.edu. Look at their programs in the aviation maintenance technology. And it's really a great thing that they're doing there. They're moving the needle forward as far as accelerating the program and also giving you some skills that can be used right now, today, to make a career for the rest of your life, and I think that's terrific. Also, if you're looking to pay for that, there's a real easy way to do that, and that's actually obviously through loans, but also through scholarships. And the sponsor of this podcast is the Law Offices of Robert M. Strumer, LLC. They're going to give you a free scholarships guide by using that coupon code STRUMERLAW. www.strumerlaw.com is where you can find them, and they actually do many different things. They handle cases both in aviation safety investigations and also pilot medical certifications. Find them at www.strumerlaw.com, and you can get a free scholarships guide using that coupon code STRUMERLAW. But most importantly, if you're looking into becoming an aviation maintenance technician, or if you want to be a pilot, no matter what it is, after you're done with this video, do me a big favor. Do something today to move forward towards your career goal. It might be something as simple as discovering over at texarkanacollege.edu what it's like to be a mechanic and how you can go about becoming a mechanic. Or maybe it's just talking to your family and asking questions as to, what do you think about me doing this for a living? Maybe you're somebody that's, you know, in the middle of their career and wants to change. But the most important thing you can do for me is take one step today to move forward in your career. And I know that you will get there sooner than you think. Well, we'll talk to you next episode. Safe flying out there.